Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, unemployment checks and lowering unemployment, Frontline and insider trading, and the day we had no debt, not a penny. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 7th of January. Good as always to have you with us. Congress is a funny thing. Sometimes it takes its own sweet time getting around to stuff, and sometimes it just up and catches you by surprise. Today was a surprise day. A filibuster-proof 60 members of the United States Senate decided early in the day and without a whole lot of notice that it's okay to talk about renewing extended unemployment benefits, the ones that expired 10 days or so ago. So the debate will continue in the Senate and the House on the merits of the bill. And one of the Republican talking points will surely be that a three-month extension in unemployment checks means folks will just take 3 months longer to find a job. President Obama offered the Democratic counterpoint today at the White House.
I can't name a time where I met an American who would rather have an unemployment check than the pride of having a job.
So we asked Marketplace's David Gura to dig into that a little bit.
When it comes to unemployment, here's how Republican Senator Rand Paul puts it.
The longer you have it, that it does provide some disincentive to work.
Well, in a limited sense, that's true, but it's not huge.
Mark Killingsworth teaches economics at Rutgers. Another labor economist, Princeton professor Henry Farber, says the evidence is pretty clear.
It suggests that the extended unemployment insurance benefits that we've had in the Great Recession and its aftermath have not appreciably reduced the job-finding rate.
Having those benefits, Farber says, might extend the period of time someone's unemployed, but just by a couple of days.
The view that somehow by providing people with extended benefits, they're just sort of living the fat and happy life and don't need to look for work and are not finding jobs does not seem to be borne out in any data that I've seen.
What the benefits have done, Farber says, is keep out-of-work Americans from leaving the workforce altogether. Mark Killingsworth at Rutgers says what's missing from the U.S. economy right now is demand, both for goods and services and workers.
If we don't do anything much to demand, then everybody is going to be scurrying around looking for jobs that don't exist.
Labor economists have studied unemployment benefits, but for the most part, they've done that when we've had what they call a normal economy. And that's not how they describe the economy today. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
In corporate news today, AT&T has an idea that may well mark a change in mobile video. It's called sponsored data. It would let companies send free content to our various mobile devices. Think movies, mostly for that content. And then we can watch it without that data eating into our data plan. AT&T says it's a bit like 1-800 numbers, word of phone service. So we got Marketplace's Mark Garrison on that story.
First, for our younger listeners who grew up with nationwide calling plans, the introduction of the 800 number was a big deal back when people used landlines and paid long-distance charges. Just Google it or something. That was about companies letting you call them without paying the phone company. Now, companies can do the same with content. AT&T spokesman Mark Siegel explains what that could mean.
You wanted to have someone see movie trailers and not have to spend their mobile data package on it or try games.
And that's a golden opportunity for companies to reach customers wirelessly. Imagine a company selling a tablet app. Trying it out will gobble up your data plan, so many potential buyers won't bother. The sponsored data plan gives that company the opportunity to save those sales, says Constance Helfat, technology strategy professor at Dartmouth.
People might not be willing to try it if they're going to have to pay for it, and essentially you'd pay for it by having it get charged against your data plan. But if it's free, you might try it.
So this all sounds like a sweet deal. Free content for us, new opportunities for companies. Critics aren't sure. Harvard Law professor Susan Crawford worries about a scenario where rich companies can keep upstarts down by buying special access to customers. Remember, AT&T is charging companies for sponsored data.
If they're small, they may not be able to afford to pay AT&T for the privilege of reaching AT&T's data customers.
And if they can't reach those customers, small companies making innovative content may not be able to succeed. It's also an open question whether companies like Netflix and YouTube will even go for this deal. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, up. Next question? Yeah, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Jury selection began today in the Justice Department's insider trading case against a man named Matthew Martoma. Martoma is part of a much bigger federal investigation into a hedge fund called SAC Capital, which at its peak held $14 billion under management. Over the summer, SAC agreed to the biggest insider trading fine in the history of insider trading fines, almost $2 billion. Martoma is the eighth executive from SAC to face charges. The other seven have all pleaded guilty or have been convicted. But the big fish for the feds is SAC founder Stephen A. Cohen. SAC, Stephen A. Cohen. Anyway, there's a new documentary on Frontline tonight about Cohen and SAC and the mysteries of insider trading. It's called To Catch a Trader. Martin Smith is a correspondent on that piece. Martin, it's good to have you with us.
Very good to be here.
Maybe the place to start is with Stephen Cohen. Who is he? Where did he come from? And why is he involved in this?
Stephen Cohen is a legend on Wall Street because from the time that he founded SAC Capital in 1992, he produced incredibly good returns. So good that he was able to charge his clients hefty fees and still return to them an average of more than 30% a year for a good long time running.
How then did it, escape notice? How did it go on for so long with this guy beating the market? And as you have Charlie Gasparino from Fox News saying,
if you walked up to a typical Wall Street trader and would say, hey, is there insider trading at SAC Capital going on? After the guy falls on the floor dying of laughter, we'll get up and say yes.
How does that happen? How does nobody notice?
It didn't escape attention. In fact, people started to pay close attention. But the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's offices, were not really looking at hedge funds until the mid-2000s. And, of course, the first target that they took on was the Galleon Group headed by Raj Rajaratnam. But it was from that case that a number of people were targeted, pled guilty, flipped, and they started to point to SAC Capital as the place that the feds ought to go next.
Just to give an indication of how this works, I'm going to play a little piece of tape from the film about how this insider trading went. And here it is, and we'll talk about it.
I remember sitting there on the desk one day, and Raj Rajaratnam was out, and the phone rings, and I'm like, Galleon. And he's like, is Raj there? I'm like, no. So he's like, Jeffries is going to upgrade Amazon in 6 minutes. Click. And so I'm sitting there. I'm like, oh, my God, what do I do? And so I sat there for 5 minutes sort of trying to make a decision. And I ultimately ended up buying 100,000 shares of Amazon. 30 seconds later, I made about $500,000. And I remember sitting there saying, wow, I'm like, if I got this call every day, I'd be a great trader, too.
That is just extraordinary.
Yeah. No, that's Turney Duff. He was a young trader working with Raj Rajaratnam, gets this call when it was supposed to go to Raj, but Raj was out of the office. And there you have an insight inside the mind of a trader as he's trying to decide whether or not to make a bundle of money or...
or stop, make a bundle of money.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
It all goes to this network that these guys created of who gets the call from the analyst. And you spend a lot of time talking about this thing called first call and the edge and the way these guys get their information. And part of it is because it's a circle, right? I mean, the traders get commissions from the hedge funds like SAC Capital, and then they are more likely to give that first call to SAC Capital and people like them.
That's right. I mean, they're going to treat their best clients with favors. And this is something of a gray area.
All right, wait a minute, though. How gray is that gray area, really? Because
not very.
I mean, that's what it all hinges on.
I don't think it's very gray. If you're in the possession of non-public material information and you trade on it, you have crossed the line. It's information that comes from inside a company, that an upgrade is about to happen, that a merger and acquisition is about to be announced, things that will move the market and that you get it ahead of time. That's illegal.
Not to end on a down note, but what are the odds that insider trading on the scale of SAC and Galleon is still going on?
Oh, I think it's most likely that it's going on. I mean, I think the feds have sort of recorded hours upon hours of phone calls and texts and emails, and they're still digging through this stuff. It's not over by a long shot. And by their own admission, They say, we don't really know how much more is out there, but we suspect there's a lot more.
The film on Frontline tonight on PBS is called To Catch a Traitor, about Stephen Cohen and SAC Capital. Martin Smith is a correspondent on that film. Martin, thanks a lot.
Kai, thank you.
We learned this morning from the good people at the U.S. Department of Commerce that the trade deficit, that is the difference between the value of what we buy from overseas and what we sell abroad, unexpectedly shrank in November. Our trade imbalance was the lowest it's been in almost 4 years. China, meanwhile, has become the world's biggest trading economy overall, if, caveat emptor here, you believe government media over there. If true, it would be quite the milestone for Beijing. If not true, well, here's Marketplace's Rob Schmitz from Shanghai.
According to the state-run China Daily, China's trade in 2013 was worth $4.1 trillion. U.S. trade is estimated to be $3.9 trillion. But according to Tom Holland, economics columnist at the South China Morning Post,
if you actually break down the Chinese numbers, you find that the third biggest source of China's imports was China itself.
So how does a country import products from itself? Here's one way. If you're a Chinese electronics manufacturer, you get a 17% tax rebate on all the goods you export. That includes exports to Hong Kong, right across the border.
On the other hand, if you import goods from Hong Kong, under a trade agreement between the mainland and Hong Kong, you don't pay any tariffs.
So now you know the rules of the game. Here's how it's played. A Chinese company loads a ship full of components and sends it on a half-hour voyage to Hong Kong, securing a 17% tax rebate for all of it. After it arrives, the same ship then heads back home to China without paying any tariffs. Money in the bank for Chinese companies and for the country as a whole, bigger trade numbers. If you take these meaningless imports and exports out of the picture, China's real trade figure last year lags behind the U.S. Here's another way trade figures are distorted in China. China's government makes it hard for companies to bring money into the country. One way to get around this is to lie to the government about the value of the goods you export. Beijing economist Michael Pettis has seen this time and time again.
That means that the amount of exports that you record are going to be false. You're going to increase the amount of exports in order to basically disguise the capital inflows.
So why doesn't China's government crack down on all of this? Again, Tom Holland.
Over time, the mainland authorities have tried to reduce the incentives for this sort of practice. But in many cases, it's the government-linked companies that benefit.
And the country as a whole benefits from the claim that China has again surpassed the U.S. to achieve another economic milestone. Except in this case, it hasn't. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You don't give up, you don't give in, and you do whatever it takes to get the job done. That's how it works.
Which includes falling flat on your face. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 105 points today, 2/3 of 1%, closed at 16,530. The NASDAQ up 39 points, about 1%, ended things at 4153. The S&P 500 advanced 11.6%, closed at 1837. Healthcare stocks rallied. United Health Group perked up 3% after Deutsche Bank upgraded the biggest publicly traded U.S. insurer to a buy. Tenet Healthcare held a 5% gain today. Casinos were on a roll. Las Vegas Sands drifted up 2.2%. Wynn Resorts won a nearly 3% gain today after analysts increased estimates of their earnings in Macau. And you, no matter where you gamble, are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to issue its monthly consumer credit report for November. 50 years ago, on January 8th, President Lyndon B. Johnson delivered his historic State of the Union address in which he declared a war on poverty. And it's Argyle Day, no doubt rapidly observed by fashionistas everywhere. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. NBC Universal paid $775 million for the rights to the Sochi Olympics that start a month from yesterday. That makes the news from skier Lindsey Vonn bad, bad news for the broadcaster. Vonn said today she is not going to be able to race in the games because of a bad right knee. Vaughn was a medal hopeful, sure, but for the network, a ratings hopeful, even more. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now on the economic power of star power.
This is how it begins.
On the floor, representing the United States of America, Gabrielle Douglas.
Then comes the gold, in this case to gymnast Gabby Douglas. Then it's off to the Today Show.
Gabby, good morning to you. Have you stopped smiling?
And wraps up on the Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
How did you celebrate? What did you do?
We didn't have time to celebrate.
That's one of the big benefits of sports programming in general.
Kenneth Shropshire is a sports business expert at the University of Pennsylvania. He says NBC buys the broadcast rights to the Olympics for a lot more than the event itself.
It really is the idea of, will this programming lead people to our network and get them to learn about the upcoming shows.
And when you have stars like gymnast Gabby Douglas on the Today Show, the thinking goes, viewers don't flip to rival Good Morning America. Obviously, having household names to launch the games is nice, but television analyst Larry Gerbrandt trusts NBC will figure out how to replace the likes of Lindsey Vonn.
Look, NBC knows how to tell these stories better than anyone. They've been doing it for almost decades now.
Gerbrandt says all the network needs is a couple of Cinderella stories, the improbable nobodies who emerge from the pack.
You can survive an entire Olympics off of a couple of those stories. And the beauty is, they almost always emerge.
The hope for NBC is enough charismatic Americans bring home gold so the company can bring home the cash. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Tomorrow marks a peculiar milestone in the history of the American economy, one that most of us, honestly, today can't even begin to fathom. January the 8th, 1835, Andrew Jackson, the 7th president of the United States, paid off the national debt, as in turned the red to black. Not just no annual deficits, but an actual positive bank balance, if you will. John Steele Gordon is an economic and business historian of the American economy. John, it's good to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here.
What did Jackson do to get the debt down? I mean, how did he do it? You know, we're spending a lot of time in Washington talking about the debt and not really doing anything about it. What did Jackson do?
Well, what he did was the government was, its tax revenues were growing because of the prosperity, but he also refused to spend that money on things like internal improvements, as they were called then. Today we call them pork. And so he kept vetoing internal improvement bills, saying as soon as we pay off the debt, then we can talk about roads and bridges. And that's what he did.
Debt was a personal thing for Andrew Jackson, wasn't it?
Yes, he'd gotten involved in a land deal, and he ended up owing a ton of money with a bunch of useless, you know, worthless notes because a partner of his had gone bankrupt. And so he really hated debt. He hated it personally, and he transferred that hate to the federal government.
What was going on that day in 1835 when Andrew Jackson said, here we are, ta-da, debt-free?
Yeah, well, they were out of debt, and the country was undergoing an enormous boom at that time. It was a great deal of prosperity.
What happened in the following years, though, I guess, is a better question.
Well, what happened is that the boom came to an end. There was a speculation in land, which turned into a bubble, and when Andrew Jackson pricked that bubble, the consequences were a deep recession or depression, which lasted 6 years, the longest depression in American history.
Let me rephrase that and not put words in your mouth at the same time. We need a certain amount of debt to make the economy function.
Well, I'm not sure we need it, but the national debt and the federal bonds and stuff are used as collateral for other things. They'd have to find where would we put that capital we now have $17 trillion of in order to use it productively.
What is this thing we have with debt? I mean, it goes back to Andrew Jackson and frankly, beyond, you know?
Well, it started in the American Revolution because we had to fight a war to achieve independence, and war is a very expensive business. So we had to borrow money or print it, which we did a great deal of, in order to win the war.
This is I will grant you a huge hypothetical, but what would happen today if, through the miracle of whatever economic science you choose to follow, we got rid of the national debt? And you know, let's say we just carried a 30-day credit card balance and that was it.
This is all very theoretical. Nobody really has any idea what would happen if we paid off the debt. Of course, we're not going to do so. You know, you could find a gold mine under Capitol Hill and it wouldn't pay the debt off.
What do you suppose Andrew Jackson says if he comes back to life today, walks to Times Square and sees that national debt clock at, what is it, $17 trillion-something dollars now almost?
I suspect Andrew Jackson would challenge him to a duel. That was usually his response to things he didn't like.
John Steele Gordon is a business and economic historian. His most recent book is a revision of a book he wrote called Hamilton's Blessing. It's about the debt. John, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
If you wanted to point to a highlight of the American economy the past couple of years, Silicon Valley would be a good place to start. Web 2.0, social media, you know what I'm talking about. Success there means you've made it, right? Well, except there's a whole lot of failure in Silicon Valley as well. Startups stopping, venture capitalists losing. Failure happens so much in tech, in fact, that they kind of celebrate it, most pointedly at a conference held every year in San Francisco known as FailCon. Our wealth and poverty reporter Chrissy Clark was there.
The basic principle behind FailCon is a bit like the one behind Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. If you want to overcome your failures, first you've got to admit them. And so here's how John Crawford, the CEO of a startup called Store Envy, started his presentation.
Good morning, you guys. I'm John, and I'm going to talk to you about how to build a dysfunctional team, something I'm really good at.
There were workshops where people visualized failure and drew pictures of it, a group session with a psychiatrist, tears when a woman publicly apologized to a co-founder she had fired. But as the featured speakers climbed on stage to make their failure confessionals, certain patterns started to emerge. A lot of the stories of failure were told from the hindsight of success. That CEO who built a dysfunctional team, which he eventually fired.
We did raise $5 million more after that happened.
And then there was another speaker, Mike McDermott, who came on stage to talk about his company, FreshBooks. It used to have a different name until everyone told him it sucked.
This is the story of a company that failed in making its biggest branding decision, but it still succeeded in going on to become number two in America for online accounting solutions.
Kind of more like humble brags than admissions of failure, right? And that's the thing about failure, Silicon Valley style. In everyone's rush to embrace it, the meaning of real failure, like fall on your face, serious desperation kind of failure, that seems to get lost. But that was okay by Haiti Moreno and Vineet Modi. They were two FailCon attendees I met over lunch. Like a lot of FailConners, they had each left their jobs recently to try to start their own companies. They'd come here with elevator pitches in hand. Here's Modi's.
We help homeowners discover a home that matches their lifestyle.
And here's Moreno's.
An app to reduce roommate tensions.
And being first-time entrepreneurs.
I don't know if I can say this on air.
Don't worry, we'll bleep it.
But I'm scared shitless.
So hey, a story of a failure with a happy ending? Yes, please, says Moreno.
I think in the entrepreneurial world, there's a lot of fail often, fail fast. And you hear it's a mantra and you hear that so often. And I just really like real world examples of what does that mean and what does it look like.
But what failure, quote unquote, looks like at FailCon isn't always the whole picture. Because here in Silicon Valley, appearances matter a lot. Janice Fraser has been coming to FailCon for a few years now. She's been a speaker, a failure mentor. She's been involved with 6 startups herself.
And many of them have failed. And a couple of them have done really, really well.
And Fraser says people keep track of this stuff.
I think that Silicon Valley has an ambivalent relationship with failure. It talks a lot about failure, and yet there's still an embarrassment or a resistance. I think that you can withstand one failure if you have another success, but then if you have a couple failures in a row, it's going to not look good.
I was taught that quit is a 4-letter word.
That's Jason Shen, one of the last FailCon speakers of the day. Stanford grad, NCAA gymnastics champ, after tearing every ligament in his knee. In other words, failing is not his thing.
You don't give up, you don't give in, and you do whatever it takes to get the job done. That's how it works.
But that is not how it worked with his startup, a ride-sharing app called RideJoy. Shen raised more than $1 million in venture funding for it. But then, he told the audience, his team struggled to bring in enough new customers to keep their investors happy. So the money they had left, they gave it back and quietly called the company quits. Offstage, Shen told me something he did not mention in his speech, that this all happened right around the time a flashy story about their company came out in Vanity Fair.
And it was like, oh my God, it's so great, you're in Vanity Fair, that's so cool. And we're like, we're doing some other stuff right now. But like, you're just like, yeah, thanks.
Shen says it was really hard to find a silver lining or a useful lesson from all that.
When I was trying to come up with my speech, my quote-unquote takeaway was, when you do a startup, you do things and then things happen. It's very random.
He worked with a speech coach, did some polishing, and eventually came up with this conclusion, which he told the audience on stage at FailCon. Quitting sucks, he said.
But sometimes you have to make room in your life to have something amazing be there.
The crowd clapped. It was time for questions. One woman asked, so what's the amazing thing you've made room for? Shen said he's still trying to figure that part out. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of, come on, how did you not see this coming, people? The cold weather equivalent of frying an egg on a sidewalk is, of course, throwing boiling water into the frigid air to watch it freeze. So here with today's lesson from YouTube in Don't Let This Happen to You.
Here goes Micah's experiment.
Oh, you just got hot water on me.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry. Marketplace angle, none at all. Just looking out for you. Don't do that. All right, that's Marketplace from 8 p.m. today. Nancy Fargali and John Ketchum are the producers on our desks. I am Kai Rizdahl. Tomorrow, same time, same channel. We'll see you then. This is 8 p.m.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.